Hi everyone, thanks for joining us. You're about to listen to a conversation with authors Anne Boyst and Graham Simpson. Anne is the Chair of Women's Mental Health at the University of Melbourne and author of the psychological thriller Medea's Curse, Dangerous to Know, and This I Would Kill For. Graham is an internationally best-selling author of The Rosie Project, The Rosie Effect, and The Best of Adam Sharp. We were thrilled to host them in conversation discussing their latest book, The Oasis, which is the second gem in the groundbreaking Menzies Mental Health series. This thoughtful collaboration combines Anne's professional expertise and Graham's distinctive storytelling voice, and we are so thrilled to host the pair live. Just a note that this conversation explores and discusses mental health, and we understand that some of our listeners may find some of the topics that are brought up challenging. This recording was made in front of a live audience at the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts in the Henry Carmichael Theatre, which is located on Gadigal land.
Thank you to the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts, and thank you to all of you for coming along. And part of having this conversation is the inspiration for writing these books. I'm a psychiatrist, and talking about mental health I think is incredibly important. We started this process off, well, we've actually written two books together before this, but we started the process of the Menzies Mental Health series with The Glass House, which came out last year, and we toured with it, and this is the sequel, and we will tell you about the sequel. But before we do that, and we'll also do a lot of the things that Sophie suggested we were probably going to talk about.
Yep, now we've got the brief.
Yep. But before that, I'm going to hand over to Graham to just talk a little bit about the 5 months we had on tour and some of the sort of feedback we got and how that informed us going forward.
Well, let me start with the first feedback we got, which was basically from our publisher, who said, mental health, pretty grim stuff, isn't it? Grim? I mean, what is the most popular genre out there at the moment? It's crime, dead bodies. Well, maybe romance, but don't spoil a story. So crime, dead bodies, forensic examination, blood, all that sort of thing, but mental health could be grim. And look, it took a while before we found a new publisher who was, I mean, our previous publisher would have published it, but who was really enthusiastic and excited about the book, which was Hachette. But we realised that, well, going back 12 years now, I had a book called The Rosie Project, and it's been a very successful book. It sold several million copies around the world. And it's easy to forget how hard it was to get that book off the ground originally, because it didn't fit neatly into any genre. It wasn't a conventional sort of romance, certainly not with a male protagonist with autistic and so forth. It wasn't a crime novel or anything like that, and it wasn't going to sell itself. And we were very, very fortunate that independent booksellers, particularly like Abbey's out in the foyer there, thank God they still exist, hand-sold the book. Basically, somebody would come in and say, you know, what's the latest Jack Reacher book? And they'd say, look, I know you love your thrillers, but you might find this one worth a look. And they'd read it and pass it on to someone else, and that got the ball rolling. And we realised with the reaction we got to writing the idea of a book on mental health in the mental health space, that we might need booksellers to do the same thing for us. So we thought, let's go around, let's talk to the booksellers, let's thank them, because they got us kicked off with the Rosie Project, and having thanked them, ask another favour, which is what we end up doing, and saying, could you please do the same for The Glass House, because we think it needs a little bit of help. And we said, well, which booksellers should we go to? Melbourne, which is where we live, or go to Sydney? Let's go see the lot. So we decided we would visit every bookshop in Australia, or every bookshop that might stock a copy of The Glass House. So not the second-handers or the religious bookshops or the art bookshops, but every regular bookshop like Abbey's out there. And 5 months later, 5 months after the book was published, we
30,000 kilometres.
30,000 kilometres.
Two
train trips, 30,000 kilometres. 100 events, about 2,000 books sold at events, I think.
More than 3,000 people at the events.
Yeah, and all the royalties from the books to mental health charities, so it was actually a little bit of a fundraiser as well. We left Australia, to put all those bookshops behind us. And we estimated there were 400 bookshops to visit, and we had visited 399. And we went through the international, and their Airside International was a W.H. Smith. So we went in, they had copies of the Glass House in stock. We signed them, we said 400, job done. So, but look, that was interesting, but there was another reason for going on the road. I said to thank the booksellers and to encourage them to sell more of the new book. But Anne was on a bit of a mission here. Do you want to tell everybody a little bit about that mission and what inspired it?
Well, the Rosie Project was really part of the wave of people accepting neurodiversity. And we had so many people coming up to Rosie event and effect and result events saying, "You've changed my life. I finally understand my husband." that was the most common one, I have to say.
We had people say, "I read the book and this guy Don Tillman, he seemed perfectly normal to me. So I realised if he seemed perfectly normal to me, maybe I'm autistic. So I went off and got an assessment, and sure enough, would you believe it?" And I'd sort of spotted it at 20 paces. So, you know, yes, I believed it. But, yeah, keep going.
But it was part of that wave, and I thought, well, I've been working in mental health for 40-ish years, and there's still a lot of stigma about mental health. And I thought, wouldn't it be nice if a book could just shift it that much? And I wrote a book called, very catchy title, Psychiatric Disorders Associated with Childbirth, A Guide to Management. Probably sold 50 books to the converted. I mean, it was aimed at nursing staffs and doctors, not the general public. And, of course, it only sold, likewise, you know, for that, what you'd expect. But fiction can reach so many more, and people that aren't converted. And you have an opportunity to emerge people into a story that they might not otherwise have sat with. So Graham famously says, you know, if you're reading The Guardian and you read your 800 words, you're already preaching to the converted. Or people will just read the heading and say, no, I'm not interested in that. Whereas you can kind of build things up and build empathy and two sides of a story in a novel. And, of course, in a mental health novel, when we set the Glass House in an acute psychiatric ward, a lot of different illnesses, as well as balancing the mental health worker's perspective with that of patients. Now, when we were struggling to find a publisher who was enthusiastic, some of the feedback we got was, "Oh, you can't tell this story. You don't have lived experience." But Hachette said, "What are they talking about? You have lived experience of a mental health worker."
Can I just buy in here? This is a bit of a political correctness question and all those sorts of things, saying that mental health stories can only be told from the point of view of people with lived experience of what we call complex mental health, in other words, sufferers, if you like. And I used to be a business consultant, and one of the things I learned was if you just want to be angry, you only need to hear one side of the story. But if you want to actually progress and change things and move forward, you need to hear all sides of the story. And the idea that the mental health worker's view wasn't valid and important is silly. We need to hear... mental health workers don't get up in the morning, twirl their moustache and say, "Today I do evil." They get up in the morning and they try to do their very, very best. And if we understand where they're coming from, what they're trying to do, and we understand where the patients are coming from and what they're trying to do, and we see that there's a dysfunction or a discord between the two, okay, let's work on that. But you don't suppress, I don't think, a particular point of view. But the advantage was Anne absolutely knows what she's talking about here. This is not some author who says, "I'm going to try to write this heroic doctor or something." We said, "No, we can write doctors and nurses and administrators, warts and all."
And this is both books are very warts and all. But the balance, I think, is very hard for someone who's been in the system as a patient to write a balanced book. And the memoirs that are out there are fabulous. There are some great memoirs that really give the perspective I can't give. But it's very hard, I think, for them to see people like me and the nursing staff, etc., as anything other than the bossy people that are making them do things that they don't want to do.
People have said to us they found people with lived experience, they found the glass house, and indeed those who read The Oasis, confronting, not so much because it told them something awful, but it humanised the people that they weren't very keen to humanise. You know, people who'd made their lives very tough from their point of view, and here they're being presented sympathetically as having home lives and love lives and their own conflicts and so forth. That's an awful lot to deal with when you try to sort of put them in the box and say, look, they're the enemy I'm trying to get past.
So, you know, part of being on the road was getting feedback from people. We'd already put the book, both books, past a whole lot of specialists in the field, but also lived experience and an Indigenous sensitivity reader, because we've got an Indigenous doctor, and got lots of feedback. We'd incorporated that in. But, you know, we needed to get it out there and get real feedback from people who were reading it. And we were pretty humbled by a lot of what we heard.
Can I say that every time we signed over 2,000 books on the road. Every time we signed one, we wrote talk about it on the book. Because we were trying to stimulate discussion, and that was one of the points of having the book out there in the first place. And wow, we got some of that. We got people talking about it with us. We got people sort of bailing us up in the corner sometimes and not giving us a chance to get away to dinner.
And interestingly, if it was anything to do with schizophrenia, depression, anything like that, came straight to me. If it was autism, went straight to him. And that was rightly so, because when I trained, autism wasn't even in the DSM. You had to be a child psychiatrist to even know what Asperger's was. I have since trained in ASD, so I know a lot more about it now. But so we'll just kind of give a couple of stories of the sort of feedback we got. And I guess one of the most humbling ones I got was that was a woman, probably maybe a little bit younger than me, whose son had been diagnosed with schizophrenia. And I think schizophrenia is one of those words that when you hear it, it's a bit like cancer. If you're sitting and you've just heard it for the first time, you don't hear anything afterwards. Because I'm sure that in the acute psych hospitals, the doctors do tell family what to expect, what the what this disease is, etc. But this mum clearly hadn't heard it, because I think it had just kind of gone in one ear and out the other. And she said, thank you so much for the book, because it helped me really know a lot more about the system I've been exposed to and understand the other side, and it really helped me with that. So it's a very overtaxed system. Your system here in New South Wales is particularly stressed at the moment. I don't pretend to really understand what's kind of gone on, but it's clearly very stressed with psychiatrists resigning and the registrars sort of really in. Hannah, our protagonist, is a psychiatric trainee in psychiatry. She's already stretched, and I think your current registrars are going to be currently stretched even more so. Are you going to give another story from the road?
No, I just go nuts every time she says registrar, because it's one of those technical terms.
Mostly been saying trainee psychiatrist.
I know, but it's the language sometimes, and it's such a barrier. And one of the reasons it was helpful having two of us writing this was I'm the guy who's constantly saying, what is DBT, or you know, what is a registrar, or whatever? And what's the difference between a psychiatric registrar and a trainee psychiatrist and a psychologist, for that matter? And a lot of these things are not particularly well known or well understood in the community. I mean, it's interesting, just jumping ahead to the Oasis for a moment, that Hannah, our protagonist, comments, she's trying to deal with a patient that is very difficult and complex. And she says, wow, I'm just a sort of junior and it's been thrown on me. If you turn up in the Australian health system and you've got a heart complaint or you've got cancer or something wrong with your kidneys, your expectation is that you will at some point be assessed by somebody who's as expert as they can get in this game. And if it's too complicated, they will pass you on to someone else, and eventually you will get the level of expertise that you need. And following that, you will get the best level of treatment that we know available based on the evidence. Mental health, very, very different. Lots and lots of people madly stretched, junior, with inadequate tools and so on. We did an event, so we're talking about stuff on the road again, but we did an event in Mildura, and a whole lot of mental health workers turned up with a quote on their T-shirts.
From the book.
from the book.
Oh, they printed it, bless them.
Which said something along the lines of, our knowledge is so thin, our tools so inadequate, our resources so thin, you know, ourselves so human. So they really related to that sort of feeling. You want to tell us another story from on the road, Anne? Because
I thought it was your turn to tell another one.
I just did. Oh, I thought, well, that was a story from on the road.
Well, seeing we're jumping between books, I'll tell the Heidi Everett one, because Heidi Everett is a woman who has schizophrenia and autism, and she wrote a book called My Friend Fox. It's a beautiful memoir where what she the excerpt she read out had people...
This is at our first, the launch of the first book.
At the first launch of The Glass House, had people, you know, laughing. But it was very much about a group of patients with largely schizophrenia being pushed in and out of a bus by nursing staff. And she struggled, she was one of the people that sort of struggled with our book. And there's a podcast we've got at the moment called, well, we don't, but Carolyn Kelly has done a bookcast podcast called Talking the Glass House, and has Jayashree Kulkarni, who's a professor of psychiatry, talking with Heidi Everett, does one of the podcasts, and Ariane Beetson, who's written Because I'm Not Myself, You See, about postpartum psychosis, and talks about the characters in our book and what real life experience is like and how similar or not they are.
So you basically take the book as a bunch of case studies and say, is this real? What's it really like to have postpartum psychosis or anorexia nervosa, whatever, and doing exactly what we wanted people to do, talk about it, use that as a starting point, say, that wasn't my experience, okay, but you've got a baseline to talk on.
When Heidi was talking, I mean, I'm a psychiatrist of, you know, well, 35 years as a trained psychiatrist, but I started 40 years ago. As a qualified. But she made a point about being made an involuntary patient. And in perinatal psychiatry, I don't often sign papers for that. It's pretty uncommon. We largely voluntary patients. But I have done it. And over the years, and when I'm on call, certainly had to sign those papers. And I have to be honest, it was fairly routine. It was, this patient is really unwell, they're hearing voices, they're you know, they need medication. And so signing that patient was moderately routine for me when I did it. Heidi gave a very poignant talk where she said, this robbed me of my dignity. And I went, and I will never sign one of those papers again without thinking quadruple, is this the right thing to do for this person? And we took that with one of the patients we do in the Oasis, DJ Voices, who has chronic schizophrenia. She's been on a long-term ward, and she gets herself out, as you'll hear when we do a reading. And in the book, there's a tribunal. You have a slightly different process in New South Wales, but it's very similar. It's a legal process. And she is making the case of, I do not want to be on this order. And we put her case, and we also show that the mental health worker's case of when things don't go so well when she's not on an order. We try to balance it as much as possible to give both sides in a very human way. And obviously I don't have lived experience of mental illness, but...
not obviously at all.
The day-to-day stuff of, you know, I've certainly had a time when my first marriage broke up where if I'd rocked up to a GP, they probably would have given me a script for an antidepressant. And so, you know, but I don't consider I can represent it in a way like Heidi Everett can. However, I love my patients with a couple of very clear exceptions. But mostly... I really feel for them, even when I've been dragged in at horrible hours of the day or on weekends and stuff. You know, I'm in there for 30 seconds and suddenly I'm there. I'm there for them. What can I do to help you? And so I hope that comes through on the page.
So interesting that the goal to get a conversation going got something said that even influenced Anne's thinking, feeding back and so forth. Another story from the road, there was a point where we were at our furthest distance, I think it would have been probably from Melbourne, up there in Port Douglas, and we got a phone call from home with a serious health crisis, which required that Anne fly home. And we had planned, I'm back of Queensland and New South Wales coming back home, there aren't a lot of bookshops. So it was a lot of kilometres, you know, 700-800 kilometres a day, two drivers, just get the job done and just have a couple of bookshops along the way. And of course I'd do that solo, and said to the booksellers, you know, look, we can cancel. No, do it solo. So
could answer the psychiatry questions by then.
Yeah, but that's right, I could answer the psychiatry questions. I was used to that. But we were there 40 years. But I was driving back and God, I'd get into town and it'd be 6 o'clock, I've been driving all day, and then you have to go to the library and or whatever, the local bookshop, and do your talk, etc. But a woman took me aside and she said, I'm really sorry Anne isn't here because I've got an important message for her. She said, in the early part of in the first page of the Glass House, there's a statement that says, a sentence says, acute psychiatry is the emergency medicine of mental health for the stuff nobody saw coming. And she said she read that sentence and she couldn't go on. She said this was something that happened with her husband. He was still living apparently, you know, so he'd made it through, but something out of the blue had happened for her husband, and she said, I could not read on. And she said, I came back to the book 2 weeks later and began my healing journey, and the book was my guide for my healing journey. And she said, so I just want you to please thank Anne. I thought, hey, I wrote that sentence.
I wrote the rest of the book.
So occasionally I write a sentence that lands, including the one those mental health people put on their T-shirts, because somebody's me just trying to find words around things that Anne regards as a commonplace, and I'm the outsider saying, wow, this is really amazing stuff. And happens all the time. Tell us another story.
We keep getting out of order. I'm going to have to tell the story of the man whose name I've forgotten.
Why don't you tell a story about the anorexia nervosa?
I've forgotten that one. Thank you.
Then we can tell the stories that we like telling.
So that and this kind of does lead into the Oasis as well, is the hardest character for me to write in book one was Chloe, who has severe anorexia nervosa. And if ever there was, people would come up and say, I want to give this to X, Y, or Z, or I'm going to read this, they're sort of trigger warnings you need to kind of, is there anyone that you wouldn't recommend it for? And I guess that I would still say this, is if you've just had your daughter diagnosed with anorexia nervosa, The Glass House is not the book to pick up, because Chloe is at the end stage of anorexia nervosa. And just like most illnesses in psychiatry, there's a 30%, 30%, 30%. 30% do really well. And if you've just had your daughter or you have just been diagnosed with anorexia nervosa, now hopefully you're going to be in that 30%. There's 30% that might have some ups and downs and some difficult times over a number of years, but they're going to get there eventually. And then there's 30% that do really badly. And Chloe is one of the doing really badly group. But we walked into a shop where booksellers have these little cards where they're recommending a book. There was a lovely little mention of The Glass House and how wonderful it was by Jan. And I said, oh, is Jan here? And they said, no, Jan couldn't come in today. She had something on. But I think you should know. And Jan had said some lovely things about The Glass House. But I think you need to know that she lost her daughter to anorexia nervosa 2 years ago. So I'm thinking perhaps for her, it was a part of her healing journey. I'd still not recommend it for people who had just been diagnosed with anorexia. But I think that would be my only kind of absolute warning sign, warning trigger for that book. Just to go on to the Chloe was a big part of book one. She was one of the three patients we followed through the book, and in the Oasis we follow three patients through the book, and in this case the flow on from Chloe is actually the younger sister Brianna, because mental illness affects the whole family quite often. Brianna doesn't have an eating disorder. She's essentially a troubled teen who's kind of been a bit cheesed off that her parents were focused on her older sister. But it has repercussions, as does the dynamics of the family and a very dogmatic father. And so we follow Brianna through the Oasis.
And that sort of, let me just speak for a moment about the writing process very briefly. We'll talk a little bit more in a few minutes. But we have responsibilities, Anne and I, in these books. Anne's ultimate responsibility, the buck stops with her on authenticity. If someone reads that book, one of our books, and says, that would never happen, nobody would be given that dose of that drug, that is not typical of that illness, that's misleading, and so forth, that's on Anne. And Anne consults with other psychiatrists and with people with lived experience to make that as authentic as possible. And one of the great things about the books has been how popular they've been with mental health professionals, because they're not Nurse Ratched on the page. They're people who are human, and they can give it to friends and family and say, this is what I actually do at work, and think, when the people have read this book, they'll be smarter at the end of it rather than misled. But
a couple of my colleagues have had to put it down and pick it up again because it was giving them PTSD about their training experiences. It is very like what it really is like.
But we do not, you know, just because it's authentic doesn't mean it's, you know, it's based on or inspired by real people, but real people are not on the page. You know, it's Anne's experience of a range of people, and then you create a character out of that. But if you write authentically, you are going to find amazing sort of coincidences that people come and say, that happened to me. And you've never met them before or anything like that. But there was one at one of our very early events. We often have opening acts. So somebody who's perhaps an emerging writer, we gets 5 minutes to do a reading at the beginning, just because we think we're rock stars. So, you know, you have to have an opening act and so on. And our opening act in Traralgon, Victoria that night was an older Iranian man who hadn't even published a book, but he was working on a novel that had been started by his daughter. And his daughter was Marsha Miran, who wrote a book called Pomegranate Soup, which was very successful. But in her father Abbas's words, after a struggle with writer's block, she lost her life. And he was trying to continue the work and finish the book. Chapter 5 of The Glass House is a story of an Iranian woman with writer's block. It's just like, give me a break here, who incidentally shows up, and Hannah, our protagonist, is like, oh my God, I'm dealing with people with end-stage anorexia nervosa, 17-year-old who's just been diagnosed with schizophrenia, which is likely to change his whole life, people who've made suicide attempts, and this woman's complaining she's got writer's block and wants her help. But of course, this was the message that early intervention, getting in there early with people who have these sorts of problems, may stop the sort of outcomes that Abbas had. Let's do one more story about the road, and then we'll talk to you about writing the and what's in the Oasis.
Well, and really it's the story of this road trip, which is only a week as opposed to 5 months last year. But when we launched the Oasis in Melbourne 2 nights ago, Neil Cole talked. Sort of launched it for us. And Neil Cole's an ex-Labor Victorian MP, also a lawyer, who was outed as having bipolar disorder by the opposition party and resigned 30 odd years ago. Yeah. And he found this book, particularly confronting, because he identified very heavily with Max. Max, we meet in the first book, and we're going to see him in this book, and we're going to see him in the third book as well. Max is a barrister with bipolar disorder, which is actually not that unusual, and he runs into troubles with lithium. He's had to stop taking his lithium because lithium has messed his kidneys. Now, this is a common
thing. Rock in a hard place. Yeah. You know, what do I have? Do I treat my mental health or do I treat my physical health?
And, of course, Neil had had the similar problems, and he'd had to come off the lithium because it was causing his kidneys to fail. And he identified with it because it's a common story. It's not because we knew Neil's story or I knew a particular person with bipolar. It's a common story, and so he was identifying with that. So we do see Max in the background of this. He's not one of the patients we follow. We've already told you we follow Brianna.
So we're now going to talk about the Oasis, right? So before you tell us about the main big arcs in it, let me just say a couple of things about our writing and what we tried to do with these books and our writing process. Our challenge with these books was that we wanted to look at a number of different mental illnesses, and we also wanted to follow the clinicians, the doctors, the nurses, the administrators as they dealt with it. And the trouble is, if you try to put a dozen mental illnesses, you know, patients with mental illnesses, horses and their families and so forth into a book, along with all of the staff and so on, you're going to be trying to follow 50 characters and you will go utterly nuts. You'll have to keep case notes or something. So we ended up on a structure which is very common on television, but not so common in books. So these books are structured like a TV season. We'd say it's your favourite medical drama in a psych ward in a book. Patient of the week becomes patient of the chapter, as it were. We meet them, we see them, and at the end of the chapter, we may never see them again. We have ongoing characters who are our clinicians and so forth. And in each book, we have three patients who go all the way through the book. So we follow their longer journey. So that's the approach structurally to the book. And the way we write it is that we learnt that the first book is that we plan it out. If you're going to write together, you've got to plan it out or you go mad. You plan the thing out in meticulous detail, scene by scene, about 120 scenes for a book, like a screenwriter on cards. And you know the shape of the book, you know the ending. This may change, but that's... And then you work together. Now, in our earlier books, Two Steps Forward and Two Steps Onward, we had two voices and we took it in turns to write the different voices, alternating chapters. But this time, Anne's the expert. She's the procedural expert. So at the beginning of The Glasshouse, if you've read it, there'll be a card that says, Sian is admitted to the acute psych ward. That's what has to happen. But how does that happen? Do the cops bring her there? Do the CAT team bring her there? Does she turn up by herself with her family? Does she go by the emergency department? What happens when she arrives? Is she met by a doctor, a nurse, an administrator? Do they fill in forms? Do they contact? How does all this work? I wouldn't have a clue. I just say, Sian is admitted to the acute psych ward. But Anne sits down and writes 500 words, describes the place, describes what happens. So the process we have is that Anne writes from those out. Joint plan, which we've discussed together, she writes a crude first draft. And let me tell you the word crude I use advisedly here. And then she fixes it because giving it to me to fix is not a nice thing.
No, the glass house I then handed it to Graham. We learned that was definitely going to destroy the marriage.
What is
because
this?
I have a very messy first draft. He has very clean first drafts. So now I do the first and second draft and then hand it to him.
And then it goes back and forth. We change the prose, we change the stories and so on. But given that flavour, we had in the Oasis, let's tell you a little bit about the three characters that we follow all the way through the book. Then we'll give you a little reading so you can meet one of the characters, and then we'll take some questions. So when that big hand is on the 9, we should be starting to think about taking some questions through till 7 o'clock when we wrap up, and we'll do a signing, just so you know what you're here for now. Okay?
And look, we pick up Hannah, who's a trainee psychiatrist, and it's now 4 colleagues, so they're all there, and her boss is there with a slightly new job. She's moved to the community clinic, though, so she's not in the acute psych ward. And back in the 80s, when all of the big psychiatric hospitals were closed down, it was Roselle here in Sydney, they all closed down, all the money was meant to go out into the community, and the CAT teams were meant to be just kind of, you know, the
crisis,
the really
assessment
crisis
treatment
stuff,
teams.
But everything was going to be prevented and treated and we weren't going to need the beds anymore. Well, that didn't quite work. Largely, depending on your point of view, because the money didn't go where it was meant to go back then. So, unfortunately, that's led to a lot of people on the streets and not being treated. But the community clinics are certainly there. So she's now in the community clinic treating what you would think... When we first thought of the location, we thought, it's going to be a lot of chronic schizophrenia. And so we definitely have to cover that, but we need to see other people. Could other people go to the clinic? And in fact, we managed to fill the whole book with chapters with totally different illnesses to give you that diversity. But we did need someone with chronic schizophrenia. So in the glass house, we met DJ Voices, who was someone in the locked ward who was let out on the weekends to go and play music. So when we do the reading, you're going to hear a little bit about her. So she's now out in the community with some challenges. And as I said, when she comes to the tribunal, there's the challenge of her versus the system very much. And we try and represent that. We've got Brianna, who's the younger sister of Chloe. So we get to see the family, again, another family therapy drama with her. And the third one is Taylor, who we also get to meet in the middle chapter of The Glass House. She has her night on call, so it's the total chaotic night, and Taylor is the representative of the family from, basically the family from hell, the sister...
You don't want them as neighbours.
You don't want them as neighbours. The mother is difficult. There's... family violence, there's drugs, there's everything that causes chaos. And Taylor ends up in Hannah's office, and Hannah is Googling what to do with her. And when our daughter read this chapter, she went, oh my God, Hannah is useless. She knows nothing. Well, Hannah studied medicine, and do you know how much psychiatry you get in medicine? Not much. So she's only just started. She doesn't know much. And it becomes very clear that someone with a borderline personality style disorder, it's not, I prefer complex post-traumatic stress disorder, but she's had a very difficult life, she's struggling to survive, and she doesn't turn up to appointments, and she can't afford anything in private, so no one will have her except the public system, and even then they often won't have her. So Hannah's looking at what is dialectical. She's read that DBT, dialectical behavioural therapy, is the best evidence practice for people with borderline personality, but she doesn't know how to do it. And our daughter was appalled, and the counterbalance to that is when I was a first year trainee, this was the patient I took on for my 40 sessions of private psychotherapy, which is what I had to do to pass the college exams. And that patient taught me more than anything I ever learned elsewhere in psychiatry, and I saw her for a lot longer than 40 sessions. And she still rings me a couple of times a year to say thank you and just update me with where she is. She would say I was part of what healed her, and it wasn't because I knew what I was doing. It was because I cared. And I think you have to be pretty green and care and get a little too close. My supervisor was saying, Anne, you're getting too close to this. Rightly so, and they needed to pull me back, because at one stage she rang me up and said, I've just taken an overdose and I want you to come and get me. And so I was literally grabbing my car keys, and my supervisor said, whoa, 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 Anne, what are you doing? And that wasn't the right thing to do. I had to get the address. We got the ambulance to her. So I learned a lot via my supervisors with her as well. But caring and wanting to do that was part of her healing process, because she never had... Her parents had dropped her off at it was a different country, at an orphanage, and said, we'll see you next weekend, and they came back 7 years later. And there was a lot of trauma from that.
Okay. We're just watching the time there, and we thought we'd do you a little bit of a reading to finish off with. Anne does the drafts, but every chapter begins with a little bit of a vignette, just like an opening of a TV episode, a little vignette from the patient's life, and I get to write the vignettes, so I get to read this little vignette,
and then I edit them,
and then we follow with whatever Hannah is doing, and it's all in her voice. So I'll read a little vignette from the very beginning of the book, and then Anne will give you an even shorter bit about Hannah's buying in, and just the clue that the person walking into her office or into her community centre is the same guy that we've just seen in the opening. So it's not a major spoiler there. So I'll read you that, but before I do, because that'll be the end, before we take questions. No, actually, we'll do that and we'll do questions and then we'll buy books. That's how it works, isn't it? Yeah, okay, good, okay. The guy getting out of the battered hatchback has tried to strike a balance between fitting in and hiding his identity. His orange safety vest and the extension ladder protruding from the back of the vehicle, red briefs tied to the last rung, give a fair impression of a tradie or cleaner. The hoodie, head torch, and the bag of rope he's unpacking suggest a burglar or someone breaking out a prisoner. The latter is pretty much what he's aiming to do. Inside the Menzies Mental Health Services Extended Care Unit, dance music producer and inpatient, DJ Voices, is pulling the top off a piano stool. It arrived a few days ago, along with a new keyboard that she'd been permitted to accept as a gift. In the stool's storage cavity, beneath a false bottom, are two small audio players packed in bubble wrap. DJ's accomplice, the guy outside with a ladder and rope, visited earlier in the week, and they scoped out where to put them. A fist-sized hole in the wall of the common room and a gap at the back of the bench in the tea room. DJ is 32 with green hair, dressed more neatly than the other patients in jeans and long-sleeved T-shirt, street clothes for the street outside. She's significantly overweight, a side effect of the antipsychotics. They also have a sedating effect, but right now the adrenaline is cutting through, giving her clarity, as it does when she performs. Her accomplice is wired too, but he's struggling to get the ladder extended and propped against the courtyard wall. And now the tricky bit, the other side, where DJ voices will have to climb up. No way could he get a second ladder over, and no way could she pull herself up a rope. His solution is a rope ladder anchored to the hatchback's bumper. After three trips up the regular ladder, he gets the length of the securing rope right. A helicopter might have been simpler. DJ has hit play on the audio units and dropped them into place and is waiting in the common room for the fun to begin. It doesn't take long. Help! Let me out! I'm trapped! I can't breathe! Oh, nice clean sound and surprisingly loud. She can barely suppress her laughter. Let them be freaked out by voices for a change. And they are. Commotion, then a cloud yellow over the PA system. People arriving. She waits for the confusion to build, then heads for the courtyard. Only to find that that's where the staff are shooing her fellow inmates, clearing the building. No chance for her to get to the ladder before they see it. I'm dying in here, screams the audio player in the tea room as security guys tear a cupboard apart. More responders are coming through the main door, unfamiliar faces. They don't know her either. She grabs a student nurse's jacket, complete with name badge, Tom, from the back of a chair, steps aside as the security guy barges in and walks out through the open door.
There's a weird guy insisting he sees you, like, right away. The gum-chewing temp standing in the doorway of my office apparently hasn't done the respect is expected module. In a mental health service, weird is normal, though we avoid both those words when we're talking about patients. But here at the outpatient clinic, walk-ins aren't so normal. However, my 9 a.m. appointment hasn't turned up. That's normal, so right away isn't actually a problem. Gumchewer adds that the weird guy won't give his real name, calls himself Frodo. Does he look... I stop. She said weird. Anything more specific, that's my job.
So that's where we are, and that's a taste of the book. Look, we would love you to grab a copy, but we'd be honest... You really want to read The Glass House first, and Abby's fortunately had that for sale as well. We really need bookshops like Abby's bricks and mortar bookshops. You don't get internet bookshops whose names start with A turning up and helping at these sorts of events. And I'll just say, look, you can get the book from the library, you can get the book cheaper. But my mum used to buy all her Christmas presents well before Christmas. She'd just take opportunities, and by Christmas time, she had them all piled up. And she would have gone to a book event like this, and she'd have come back, and to my father's annoyance, she would have said, I've got Auntie Thelma's and Cousin Kevin's and so-and-so's Christmas presents all sorted out, signed copies of this book, which you'll find very interesting. So I just leave you with that thought before we take questions.
A huge thank you to Anne and Graham for such an insightful and important conversation. We really appreciate them sharing their knowledge and experience as writers. SMS members can borrow The Oasis from our library on level 2. Otherwise, you can buy yourself a copy from your local bookstore. We've put a link to our friends at Abby's in the description below. Have a lovely day, and we hope you tune in again soon.